Thank you, David, and thanks for the invitation. What I want to do today is talk about sort of about work that I have been doing over the last about 10 years on modeling drug resistance in collaboration with this list of people from various institutions. But really, rather than focus on what's been done, try to give you a sense of what I think is one of the big problems in this field. And it's one that some of these collaborators and I, have tried to solve, and I don't think we've really succeeded. So I hope somebody in the room in the next 4 weeks will solve it, and then we can move forward, because I'm pretty stuck on it. I think it's a big problem. And the problem is the long-term coexistence of drug-resistant and drug-susceptible strains of pathogens in the same population. And so what I'll try to do over the next hour and a bit is to explain why I think it's a problem. I've decided not to use PowerPoint slides in order to be less reliant on lots of data that's hard to take in large quantities. And if I have to sketch it, then that means that I'm trying to present it in a digestible way that you then have to believe me is true. But I will be happy to provide references for those who would like to see the original data. And the other reason is really to try to encourage you to ask questions or make comments or disagree or whatever along the way, because that's one of the nice things about this kind of format. So in many fields, particularly in economics and in infectious disease epidemiology and in ecology, there's a notion of competitive exclusion. That notion is that if you have two entities, in economics two firms, or in biology two species or two strains of an organism, and if they compete for a single resource, then ultimately one of them will exclude the other and will become to dominate the population, and the other strain will go extinct. In the economic notion, it's whichever one of the firms will go out of business because it can't compete. This is a notion that goes way back, and it basically comes down to a very simple idea, which is that in a closed population, if there's no source of food if there's no source of individuals coming in from outside the system, if you just have one organism reproducing and another organism reproducing, the growth rate of each of those organisms will be some increasing function of the amount of resources available. So if this is resources and this is growth rate, and you have some strain that looks like this and another strain that looks like that, for example, and this is zero, so this is net growth, then the larger the populations get, the lower the resource will go, and ultimately the resource will go down to a level at which one species is only just replacing itself. So for this species, that would be here, and for this species or strain, that would be here. And because there's always a downward pressure on the amount of resource from growing populations, this level of resource will be reached, and then this species or strain will be unable to replace itself. It'll have a negative net growth rate, and so this one will win, and this one will go to extinction. That's a very simple caricature, and it's possible to show that for a very simple environment in a flask or a chemostat for bacteria. In economics, if you replace this with price of the good that the company is selling and this with profit, then the same thing. The more efficient company will be able to make a profit or at least break even at this price, whereas the less efficient company will need this price to break even. And so this company will lower the price until it excludes its competitor. So these kinds of models have a lot of sort of intuitive appeal. They have some explanatory power. It's actually not as simple to do in bacteria, in just two bacteria growing in a simple environment as you might think. But they have a lot of explanatory power. And the prediction in the case of drug resistance for bacterial pathogens, for example, is that there should be either, depending on the conditions, there should be a situation in which the drug-resistant strain survives better, or the drug-sensitive strain survives and reproduces better, and whichever one of those is more fit in some sense, which I'll define in a second, will drive the resource, in this case the supply of susceptible people to get infected, down to a level at which the other one can't survive. In economics and in biology, there are all sorts of ways in which this principle can break down. For example, there might be more than one resource. In most places, in most non-made-up environments, there are multiple resources, and maybe one strain is more efficient at utilizing one, and the other is more efficient at utilizing the other, and so they manage to coexist. Or perhaps they coexist because they're in not even in the same environment, so they're not competing for resources. So you have a strain here, and you have a strain here, and they coexist because they never meet, and therefore this one can drive down the resource as much as it wants, but it doesn't affect this one. You may also have a situation in which one strain, called strain 1, releases, it's the more efficient user of whatever resource is available, but it releases some waste product, which strain 2 can then grow on. And then strain 1 would exclude strain 2, except that strain 2 is able to use this waste product, which is a product of the first one. So there are various ways that competitive exclusion can be gotten around. And probably one of those ways, or some variant of those ways, is what's happening in the drug resistance, drug susceptibility competition between strains. And the puzzle I want to set for you is what are the mechanisms that do that. So let me bring it down to the specific context of drug resistance and tell you a little bit about both data and the way the simple approaches to modeling it. So if you look over the past several decades at almost any bacteria-antibiotic combination, so bug-drug combination as we say, you will find that the prevalence of resistance in that bacterium to that drug has been increasing over the last 30 or 40 years. There are a few exceptions, but basically that's a fact, and it's true in most places. But what's striking is that for very many of these bug-drug combinations, the frequency has been increasing but seems to be plateauing at somewhere between 0 and 100%. So in the pre-antibiotic era, say before 1940 or so, resistance was very rare to almost any drug in any of the bacteria that we care about, and it's gone up sometimes like this, or sometimes it took a while. But it's not at 100%. It's very often somewhere below 100%. Sorry, this is not the scale. 100 is there. And in a very few cases, as antibiotics, particular antibiotics, have gone out of circulation, there's been some downward trend, but that's actually been much rarer than we would hope for. And in some cases, we're still at this point on the curve. We're still increasing dramatically, and maybe we will get to 100%. But for a number of the very common bugs and very common drugs, we have had enough decades, really, of experience to say that the prevalence of resistance has reached what looks like a plateau. And in particular, I'm going to make use of the example a lot of penicillin non-susceptible Streptococcus pneumoniae, or pneumococcus, as I will sometimes call it. It's called penicillin non-susceptible rather than resistant because it's sort of a continuous, it's not very high level resistance, and it is in fact possible sometimes to kill even so-called non-susceptible strains with high enough levels of penicillin, and so it's not necessarily truly resistant. I'm going to use the terms interchangeably, but the literature will often say penicillin non-susceptible. So if you look at penicillin non-susceptible strep pneumoniae in countries in Europe, for example, and you look just in a given year around the end of the 90s, at the amount of daily per capita penicillin use and resistance. And the original graph was on a Logit scale. Log P over 1 minus P. Then you get a very nice sort of linear-ish looking curve that places that use more penicillin have more resistance and places that use less penicillin have less resistance. And that's a snapshot, so that doesn't tell us whether we've gotten to equilibrium and competitive exclusion has happened or not. But if you then look longitudinally at any of these countries, in each of these countries, it's been at this level, plus or minus a few percent, for somewhere between several years and maybe a decade. So it appears that use of antibiotics does something to select for resistance, but it does not take us up to 100%. And that seems to be a persistent phenomenon. So in the context of modeling drug resistance in bacteria, we can start to write down models that are very simple, and these simple models are the ones that have the property of competitive exclusion, or are among those. So let me write down a very simple model as a starting point. If you have individuals who don't have some particular organism, individuals who are carriers of or infected with a sensitive strain and a resistant strain, and this is transmission, and then maybe you have another category that's dually infected with both of these strains, and this is more transmission. And for technical reasons that I'm not going to get into, but happy to discuss if people want to, we also allow sort of knocking out of the dual strain, of the dually colonized people. If they get exposed to a susceptible strain, the susceptible strain can knock out the resistant one that they're carrying and turn them to pure susceptibility. And you have clearance. So people naturally recover. So if you have a model like that, does this make sense so far, this model? Don't want to confuse with my bad handwriting early on. And the difference in this model between being a resistant strain and a drug-sensitive strain is that the drug-sensitive strain also has an additional rate of clearance due to treatment. So the, that goes to the all R. I'm going to relabel that R and S. Apologies. If I were a good enough mathematician, there would be an excuse for this, but I'm not, so I just have to apologize. And there's treatment of the drug-sensitive leads to clearance. The treatment of the drug-resistant does not lead to clearance. So that's the advantage that there is to being drug-resistant in this model. The advantage, possibly, to being drug-sensitive is that if you're not treated, you are either more infectious or you last longer in the host, so have a longer infectious period, or you are more transmissible per moment of being infectious. And so we tend to think of some so-called fitness cost to being resistant, which is to say that in some way, it's if you're not in a treated host, it's worse to be a resistant strain than a sensitive strain. And there's a fair amount of evidence, indirect evidence, mostly in laboratory animals or in vitro experiments, very little so far in human populations, in transmission populations, but a lot of evidence in the laboratory that resistant strains are at some sort of a handicap to the sensitive strains. And that kind of makes sense. If they were at an advantage in the absence of drug, you would expect that we would have been seeing resistant strains all along. If they're neutral, you could imagine they just hadn't come along yet, but it seems that they are often at a disadvantage. So in some sense, the way that antibiotic selection works is to push the balance, which was initially toward the sensitive strain because it's more fit in some sense, toward the resistant strain because the sensitive strain gets cleared by treatment here and here, whereas the resistant strain doesn't. I've talked about fitness without defining it. The standard definition of fitness in a epidemiologic model is the basic reproduction number, which is defined as the average number of secondary cases that a typical primary case will make if it's in a fully susceptible population, a population that has no other strains of the organism circulating. And in this model, that works out to be the transmission coefficient, over the clearance rate, and for the susceptible strain, that's its own R0 over the natural clearance rate, and for the resistant strain, that's the perhaps lower transmissibility of the resistant strain intrinsically over gamma plus some treatment term. So this is the increased rate of clearance for the resistant. This is why I like chalkboards, because you can erase. Sorry. So for the sensitive strain, there's a higher beta, but also probably a higher rate of clearance due to treatment, whereas the resistant strain may have a lower beta, but a higher, but a lower rate of clearance due to treatment. It turns out that if you make this model in the very simplest way, where there's no secondary transmission, so you just have the uninfected people either getting the resistant strain or the sensitive strain, it turns out that whichever strain has the higher value of R0, the sensitive or the resistant, will exclude the other by bringing the value of X down to a low enough level that the competing strain can't maintain itself. If you do allow for this secondary transmission, secondary acquisition of another strain, then it turns out that this competitive exclusion happens almost in all ranges of parameters, but there's a very thin stretch of parameter space where R0S is nearly equal to R0R, in which the two strains can coexist. But it's a very thin band in parameter space, meaning that the range of variability of these rates that we know about and the range of uncertainty goes way beyond this little band. So it's not the generic outcome to have long-term coexistence in these models. But it is possible under very limited parameter ranges. So in this simple model, we predict competitive exclusion, and so we don't have a very good explanation for what we observe in penicillin-resistant Strep pneumoniae and several other community-acquired pathogens. Several years ago, with Bruce Levin and Carl Bergstrom, we looked at this question for hospital-acquired infections, where we think we do understand what's going on. There's again the phenomenon of coexistence. I'm going to come back to the penicillin-resistant pneumococcus in a minute, but the phenomenon of coexistence is also true, long-term coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains in hospitals. And for hospital pathogens, you can draw the same picture of uninfected people, people who have the sensitive strain, and people who have the resistant strain. But in a hospital, you have one crucial difference, which is that in the hospital, there's a very large amount of openness to the system. There's entry of people and exit of people as they get cured or don't get cured and are sent back out of the hospital. And therefore, this is no longer a closed system, which, as I mentioned, is one of the presuppositions of competitive exclusion. And in particular, people often come in already colonized with sensitive strains of bacteria. Occasionally, they come in with already colonized with resistant strains of bacteria. And in this open system, it turns out that you can maintain, maintain coexistence of the sensitive and resistant strain, because under antibiotic pressure in the hospital, the resistant strain may be at an advantage, but the sensitive strain is constantly coming in and can't disappear immediately, so there is coexistence through this simple mechanism of just entry and exit. But for community-acquired pathogens, that doesn't seem like a very likely explanation, mainly because communities as large as countries, of course, do have immigration and emigration, but the rate is very small compared to the rates of to the dynamic rates of these pathogens, which tend to transmit on a timescale of weeks to months. So in community-acquired pathogens, we need to come up with some other explanation. And I want to consider three of them. The first is they're just slow. The second is that coexistence is maintained by serotypes, which I'll explain in a second. And the third possibility is that models are too simple. And that we need to invoke something more than that model that I drew so badly a minute ago. So the first possible explanation is they're just too slow. And that explanation would be that we've observed rising rates of resistance in various populations over some decades, and they're going to continue to rise, and although they look fairly flat over a time scale of a couple of years, we just haven't gotten to equilibrium yet, and that all of these models have stable equilibria that are competitive exclusion, and if we keep using antibiotics, we will reach that equilibrium, and we'll just do it slowly. I had actually proposed that in a paper that I wrote as my best guess of what I thought was going on about 9 years ago. And it seemed a plausible possibility in part because there was 9 years less of data suggesting flatness of the curves, and in part because nobody had really thought carefully, including me, about what the amounts of or what slow would mean in this context. But what sort of shook me from this dogmatic slumber of thinking that it was just slowness was neither of those things, but was another data set. And that data set comes from Israel, from Ron Dagan, one of the collaborators that I mentioned, in which it turns out in Israel, as here, there's a pronounced seasonal cycle in respiratory infections. So there people get more respiratory infections in the winter. And as a result of that, there's a pronounced seasonal cycle in antibiotic use. So this is time, and this is years, and this is antibiotic use. There's a pronounced seasonal cycle which peaks, antibiotic use peaks in the winter and trough is in the summer. And I'm trying to find the exact month. The peak is somewhere around December and January, and the trough is somewhere around August. And the amplitude of those cycles is several fold. It's somewhere on the order of about 3 to 5 fold. Yeah, I got it right. It's actually, it is August and December, January. And so this is about, in arbitrary units, between about 1, 3 to 5 instantaneous usage of antibiotics. And it turns out that the drug resistance has a cycle that is almost exactly in phase with that. And is not quite so large in amplitude, but is fairly impressive from about, for penicillin resistance, so high level resistance of at least 1 microgram per mil, reasonably high level resistance, goes from about 50% at the peak to about 20% at the trough. So with this, sorry, I guess the colors aren't very different, but so with this 3 to 5 fold variation in antibiotic use, there's a roughly in-phase oscillation of antibiotic resistance by about 2.5 fold. And the average over time is somewhere like this, and really hasn't changed over several years. So this makes it very hard to tell the story that in all these countries in Europe that differ in their amount of antibiotic use by several fold, that everyone has reached, what appears to be true is that everyone has reached some average, which is not 100%. But it would be very hard to tell the story that if we just wait 25 more years, they're gonna really start moving up, because we can see that in a period of about 6 months, there is the ability of a bacterial population to change its resistance frequency by several fold, whereas in response to changes in antibiotic use. Whereas if we look at the European countries, we've looked for many, many years and not seen even a doubling, much less a 2.5 fold change. This is community ear infections, otitis media isolates. So it's not... They are symptomatic. That's correct. But it's symptomatic at all times. So one reason to worry about it being symptomatic is that some of these people may have just had treatment and therefore are very non-representative. If you exclude the people who haven't been treated who have been treated in the last month or more, you get the same effect. It's somewhat less pronounced, but it's still there. So the ideal thing would be to have people to go out and just be petri dishes in the community and sample what's there. And ear infections are not a perfect petri dish, but ear infections without recent drug treatment are a not bad petri dish for kids of that age. The ability for these infections resistance levels to track so rapidly and so much and with such large variations makes it seem unlikely that if we just wait another few years, every country is going to go to 100% or down to zero if they aren't using very much. I tend not to believe that explanation anymore. As I say, partly for that reason and partly because it really, we've waited long enough and this explanation is getting a bit stale. The second possibility is that there's some other population structure of these bacteria that's maintaining the coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains. And one good candidate for that would be, in the case of Strep pneumoniae, would be serotypes. Strep pneumoniae is a bacterium that has a sugar coating on the outside, a polysaccharide capsule, and there are about 90 plus different types of those capsules. And to some extent, which is another topic I'm very interested in, mostly in the lab, these capsules are seen differently by the immune system. Not completely differently, and the coexistence of serotypes is another puzzle, but not the puzzle for today. But if we take as a given that for some reason, probably having to do with the human immune system, part of the population is going to be serotype 14, part of the population is going to be serotype 19A, part of the population is going to be serotype 19F, various different serotypes, it could be that each of those serotypes is like a separate little experiment in which resistance is either going to 100% or coming down to zero. And that when we look at the coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains in the pneumococcus, we're not actually looking at a single population. It's really as if, like I said before, you have a population over here and a population over here that never compete. For whatever reason, it does seem that pneumococcal serotypes manage to coexist over the long term. And in one country, Spain, where there's probably among the highest levels of antimicrobial use in the developed world, antibiotic use in the developed world, if you look over time in some serotypes, like serotype 1, this is time and this is percent resistant, it's flat lines at 0. So it's never gone up. And at a few serotypes, and I should remember, I'm going to pick on 19A, which I believe is one of these, but I could be wrong about that. If you look at the percent resistance over time, it has gone up and reached very nearly 100%. But if you look at most of the other serotypes in which there's some resistance, almost none of them have 100%, and they really look more like this, and have for a decade or more. The Spanish data are not the world's best. They're basically a convenient sample, and would not be how I would try to fit mathematical models. But they're actually the only case that I've ever seen in which anybody's gone up to 100%. Any place else where I've looked at serotype-specific data, resistance has not reached 100%, although in some serotypes it's essentially 0, or it is 0, and in some serotypes it's quite high. But the serotype explanation, again, does not seem to explain the coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains. So the third explanation is kind of a kitchen sink explanation, that we just haven't modeled the relevant process. And in some sense, that has to be correct, because nature is doing one thing and our models are saying another. And that means that our models haven't included the right process or haven't included it in the right way. But we've at least tried to think of what some of those processes might be. So remember, we started out with this model of X, S, R, and dual, and connections among them, which I'm not going to name for fear of mislabeling them again. So that's a pretty simple model. It assumes that everybody is interacting with everyone else. There's only one type of host. There's no difference among these hosts, except for their bacterial colonization status. And there are probably other ways that one could separate out the population. And the simplest one would be to say, well, what about by age? The largest amount of antimicrobial use is in kids, especially young kids, mainly for ear infections and other upper respiratory infections. So suppose that we separate the population, that we just double this model and separate the population into two categories. And let's call this infants or daycare attendees, the high risk or core group for both having the bacterium and for being exposed to antibiotics, and call this one everyone else. So that could just be older kids, or that could be older kids and adults, or kids who don't go to daycare. So this is the high risk group and this is the low risk group. And obviously, since we can get competitive exclusion in either one of these groups, if they never communicate with one another, then it might be that here there's so much antibiotic use that we have drug resistance as the excluding strain, and down here there's so little antibiotic use that we have drug sensitivity as the excluding strain, and that, again, by considering what are truly two populations together, we're seeing the illusion of coexistence. So that's true, but that explanation tends to break down as soon as you have any crossover such that these sensitive people can help to transmit the sensitive strain to these guys, and similarly, these resistant people and sensitive people can help to transmit the resistant strain to those guys. So as soon as these populations have really almost any interaction between them, there are you tend to get competitive exclusion, and writing down the expression for who wins is hard, but it turns out that usually, you know, if there are enough of these and there's enough antibiotic use, the resistant strain wins in both populations. And if there are enough of these and little enough use, then the sensitive strain wins. So it just sort of takes a weighted average in some way, and you get competitive exclusion as a generic outcome. And what I'm talking about right now is all in a paper by Colline. Did they get the abstract that I sent up? Did people get that? Do you know? Don't know. Okay. All right. So I'll re-email the abstract. There are some references for this, but this one is in Journal of the Royal Society Interface 2010. But the abstract has the references for basically everything I'm saying today, except for the last thing I'll talk about, which isn't published. So I'm just trying to give you the idea here, and if you want details, you can read details. So this seemed like a good idea, but this doesn't seem to work very well. And what I mean by doesn't work very well is an interesting question. Yeah. Yep. That is a fact about pneumococcal serotypes. The argument against that I made against the serotype, the balancing serotypes, was not a model-based argument, but really just based on the data in which there doesn't seem to be competitive exclusion even within serotypes. So there's no model there, so there are no assumptions there. It's just an observation about the data. But if you did try to model serotypes, you would have to include that. Yes, that is a possibility, and I will get to that at the end, because a variant, not that argument, but a variant on that argument is what I think might be going on to explain exactly this difference. So I'll get to that in a few minutes. So in this paper by Colline et al., we took several model structures that were more complicated than the simple version, than this version, and tried to ask, is it a generic outcome of these models that resistant and sensitive strains coexist? And by generic outcome, I think it's an open question what that means and how one should ask that question. What we did was to take from the literature estimates of each of the rates involved in this model, the rates being the transmissibility of the sensitive and resistant strain, the duration of infectiousness before one clears colonization, and then we don't actually know the level of fitness cost of the resistant strain compared to the sensitive. So we took a range from 0 to 50%, which we think probably covers the reasonable range. And then we did a number of random parameter draws from those ranges and asked not what were the dynamics, but just what was the final state of the model. And in some cases, we could do that analytically, but in even this case, it becomes a mess. And so we simply simulated the model forward, waited till a convergence criterion was met, and asked whether at that convergence criterion there was at least 10% representation of the minority strain between sensitive and resistant. So it was a fairly brute force way of trying to look for coexistence, and clearly a way that's sensitive to how we define these parameter ranges. If we included very large ranges of unlikely parameters, we'd be potentially searching in an area that's not interesting, and therefore we shouldn't expect to find realistic behavior. So we did our best to constrain these parameters as much as we could, but a criticism of this work, I think, would be that we don't really know what the right ranges for these parameters are. In any case, we did the very simple thing of selecting some hundreds of parameter sets from those ranges and asking for which of those sets was coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains the equilibrium outcome. So, and for this model, the answer to that was about 12%. Let me just get the correct. About 20%, rather. 20%. So for 20% of our parameter ranges, there was a coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains, and for 80%, there was not. Another approach would be, again, to start from this XSRD, and to think of treatment as another state in this model. So as we had done it so far, we had had treatment be an event. So we modeled treatment as an event in which somebody who had, say, dual colonization was returned to having only the resistant strain, or someone who had the drug-sensitive strain was returned to having no colonization. So we modeled treatment as an event. But treatment has a duration, and so you could ask, what happens if you put into the model the possibility that you are on treatment for some amount of time, and, for example, if you get treated, you go here, or if you get treated with this and you have the sensitive strain, you go here, so you have no strain, but you are under treatment, and you have, therefore, at all times, some proportion of the population is under treatment. And that, again, makes sort of a heterogeneous environment in which some strains or some people are a high antibiotic environment and some people are a low antibiotic environment. And that one also does fairly poorly. The baseline model, so let's get a scorecard. Baseline model with just the four states had coexistence in 16%. The treated state model had coexistence in 19%. The daycare model had coexistence in 20% of parameters. And then we considered two other models in which we had some amount of within host competition, so that instead of having XSR, we could have a state in which people can be dually infected and mainly having the resistant strain because they've just gotten a little bit of the sensitive strain, but then over time, because if they're not treated, if the sensitive strain is more fit, then they may go towards having mainly the sensitive strain, which is the one they transmit, and then on treatment, they might go back to having only the resistant strain, or they might go back here. So you have a within-host competition that favors the drug-sensitive strain, except when there's treatment, and you have a population-level competition that may favor the resistant strain. This is what we call Model D in the paper, and it kind of has a flavor of some work that was done now about 30 years ago by Simon Levin and David Pimentel on what they called superinfection. It has almost that flavor, and they were able to show coexistence of two strains in what would otherwise be a competitive exclusion model, and I don't want to pick on them, but I will, because why not? So the Levin and Pimentel flavor model had only 10%, so it actually did worse than the baseline model. And then we did an even more elaborate within-host competition model, which I won't go into all the details of. You can have a look if you want. And more within-host, and we got about 30%. So there are five models in this paper, and at best, with some assumptions that may or may not be very biologically realistic, but we thought were at least plausible biologically, you can get up to about 30% of the parameter values showing coexistence. So this is a matter of judgment or taste, I suppose, but we sort of thought this is not a very impressive success in our effort to find some sort of mechanism that would generically produce coexistence between resistant and sensitive strains. And basically the reason I would say that is that it goes back to this data set from which comes from, this is not on the abstract, from Goossens et al. In the Lancet. This comparison across European countries in which several fold variation, about three or four fold variation in daily per capita penicillin use produces a very lovely range of resistance frequencies. And these are not subtle differences. These are big differences in the level of use. And so to say, well, if we just get the parameters balanced and pick the right section of parameter space, you get coexistence, even 30% of parameter space to me doesn't feel like very much of parameter space. Again, it's a bit of a judgment call. But my sense is that we haven't probably landed on the correct mechanism for explaining this coexistence. Or we may have landed on part of it. It may be that maybe all of these things contribute in some sense. Certainly, there is heterogeneity in the population in both risk of getting infected and risk of using the antibiotics, and that has to, in some sense, promote coexistence, but it doesn't seem to be the whole thing. Yeah. 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 Basically, no, because basically any parameter, basically within the space, which is depending on the model, 8 or 10 dimensional, if you reduce the parameters to some summaries that seem sort of plausible, you can separate a cloud of points that are all sensitive, all resistant, and coexistence. And I'm sorry, I thought I was going to be able to show one graph, and it doesn't seem to be coming up easily. So you'll have to believe me or look at the paper, because I don't know how to show the graph here. But if you, for example, take a sort of 3D thing, and here you have the sensitive transmissibility, and here you have the resistant transmissibility, and here you have antibiotic use, you tend to get you get some plane through this where in this direction it favors the sensitive, in this direction it favors the resistant, and in this direction it favors the resistant. So way out here you tend to get the resistant, way over here you tend to get the sensitive, and in between you have a fairly thin slice within the range of all the parameters, ranges of all the parameters we considered, which were roughly calibrated to reflect this range for the antibiotic use, and you get all three possibilities. So it doesn't seem to be generically the outcome. So I think we may have found some of the factors, but I don't think we've solved the problem completely. Carolyn, the first author, and Ted Cohen were very interested in asking the question of what if you do put serotypes into a model like this. So they actually set up a model, the same models, but with the proviso that the sensitive and resistant strains tended to cause immunity to themselves more than to one another, so that it was easier to get the resistant strain if you had the sensitive strain than to get the resistant strain again. And under those conditions, you can bump up all of these. These plus a little bit of strain-specific immunity help a lot to create coexistence. But we don't think that that's makes any sense, at least in the pneumococcal context. And actually, there are very few organisms for which I know of evidence that resistant strains and sensitive strains differ in their immunologic properties in an important way. So the last bit that I want to talk about, and then I hope people will ask more questions, is the question of these different serotypes and the level of resistance that occurs in them. I lost it. There we go. And the fact that in some serotypes we have no resistance, and in other serotypes we have not 100%, but substantial levels of resistance. These serotypes in the pneumococcus differ in many ways. One way in which they differ, as you mentioned, is that some are much more common than others in colonization of the nasopharynx, which is where these organisms live and where they transmit. Another is that they differ in their duration of infectiousness. And by that I mean that if you follow someone who is currently colonized when you detect them with serotype 1, chances are in about a week they'll be decolonized. If you follow someone who's currently colonized with type 19A, chances are that it will take them a month or two to get decolonized. For whatever reason, again, we don't really know why this is, but the immune system is better at clearing some of these types, like type 1, than type 19A. Something I should have mentioned and didn't, but was raised by the question, is that in all of these models, we make the assumption that your risk of being treated is unrelated to whether you have the organism. And that sounds a little silly for many sorts of infections, but for the pneumococcus, and actually for many bacterial infections, it's not as silly as it sounds. And the reason is that these organisms are asymptomatically colonizing the nasopharynx of for pneumococcus between about 30 and 100% of young children, depending on the setting. And for many other organisms that live up there, similar proportions, or at least substantial fraction of the population, has it at all times. A small fraction of those people who have it get ear infections, which may be caused by that. They may be caused by another bacterium that's sitting there. They may be caused by a virus without a bacterium. But if you get if your kid gets an antibiotic and gets treated, the bugs in the nasopharynx don't know why you were being treated. They just feel the antibiotic, and if they're resistant, they survive it, and if they're susceptible, they don't survive it, or perhaps don't survive it. So the impact of antibiotics is kind of like, it's like random gunshot fire. So they don't provoke it. They're just bystanders. And in fact, even the pneumococcus, which is sometimes is the target, gets most of its exposure to antibiotic treatment simply by being exposed when someone is treated for whatever reason. So in all of these models, we assume that treatment is separate, is independent of whether you have the organism or not. If you don't have the organism, it doesn't have any effect on you, except to put you in that treated state, but it's assumed to be independent. Do you have a question? No. Another really important question, I think, and this is also something I probably should have talked about earlier, the pneumococcus for the drugs that are used in children does not mutate to become resistant. To become resistant, it requires the import of a large piece of DNA, which has to come from some other organism that's resistant. And so the mental model, which is translated into these mathematical models, is that treatment does not induce a sensitive strain to become resistant. Clearly, sometime in history that happened. The sensitive strain got the resistant mechanisms, the genetic information to make it resistant, and was selected by antibiotic use. But it is thought, and I think this is a reasonable starting point, that that happens only very rarely, a few times a year in the world maybe, or a few dozens of times a year. Whereas the event of treatment happens millions of times in every country almost. So that creating new resistant strains is not actually the main issue for these pediatric antibiotics. There's another class of antibiotics, the fluoroquinolones, which are used so far mainly in adults, for which resistance has so far stayed quite rare, and for which treatment can induce resistance. There's some move on now to approve these in children, and the thought is that if that happens, because children are the main vectors of these bacteria, that resistance will spread very quickly. So it's been sort of kept only in the people who don't matter from the bacterial perspective, the adults, and so far resistance has been a relatively minor issue and has come up repeatedly under treatment, but very, very little spread. So the models that I've talked about so far are really only for resistance promoting spread by killing the sensitive strain but not killing the resistant strain. I think that's an appealing argument for some organism, but I'm not sure for what organism. So for the organisms that I'm describing, as I say, most strains are causing, go unnoticed. They may or may not get treated. They are probably producing slowly growing immune responses over time. But the majority of the time, they're there producing whatever response they can produce at the mucosal level, and treatment is not stopping that. We were discussing over lunch whether that might be an issue for flu, for example, where the antiviral is very specific. It's only given, or it's only effect, it only has an effect when it's given for flu. There are no bystanders because it doesn't do anything to other organisms. And it may be that if you treat early enough, it somehow aborts the immune system, the immune response. There are articles written by the manufacturer mainly that sort of mention data that suggest you still get an immune response even if you're treated or prophylaxed early. I've never seen those data sort of in a raw form, so I don't know what to make of it. I think it's an interesting problem, but I think it's quite organism specific. No. For all serotypes, for a given drug and within a particular bacterial species, that's yes, more or less. I mean, there are, for penicillin resistance, it's import of DNA at between 1 and 3 different genetic loci, and there are various versions of the DNA you can import, but they all do something to make the protein not recognize penicillin. So there's some variation, but at the genetic level, it's the same 3 genes, and it's always replacement of some part of that gene. So I don't know if that helps. Yeah. So another simplification in all this modeling, which probably has some consequences, is not only, yes, that we're grouping resistance as if it were a single category when genetically it's heterogeneous, and the level is heterogeneous as well. So if you make a histogram of the level of resistance of different MIC is minimal inhibitory concentration. So the lowest level, the lowest concentration of the antibiotic that prevents multiplication of the bacteria. If you do a histogram for the pneumococcus, you have some that are very sensitive, and then you have another peak, and then maybe another smaller peak up here. And these are twofold dilutions, so this is log n IC. So it goes something like that. And so resistance is some somewhat arbitrary cutoff, which usually falls between these two peaks, so that it tends to be a good genetic cutoff, but it's not a perfect genetic cutoff. So we're grouping resistance as if it was a single entity. And also, there's a lot of other stuff going on in the genetic background of those strains, including resistance to other drugs, which tends to co-occur. So if you know that a strain is resistant to penicillin, you have information about its probability of being resistant to other drugs, and it's always a positive correlation in everything that I've ever seen. So there's a lot of complexity that may be part of the solution to this problem as well. Yeah. It depends. For penicillin, it's not actually, because they have the genes that are modified are essential genes. They're part of cell wall construction, and so you actually have to get a working drug-sensitive copy to come in and replace it. For some of the other resistance determinants in the pneumococcus, for example, there's a cassette which comes in with extra genes that the organism doesn't need but which make it resistant, and which can be excised. And in fact, there's an example in Iceland. They had a penicillin-resistant clone that was also resistant to several other drugs, and then at one point a strain emerged that had lost the cassette conferring those other drug resistances, and that strain seemed to do well for a while. So it depends on the drug. Yeah. Most of the data that I have described, all of the data basically that I've described, precedes the widespread availability of immunization, because most countries didn't introduce it until the last few years, and the data lag a few years. The U.S. introduced it in 2000, and Canada in the mid-2000s, but lots of European countries either just did it or haven't done it. Right, but I think that it could affect the model if we incorporated it. So far, we haven't, because we've been mainly trying to model earlier data. If you just look at the phenomenon and look at drug resistance, and the U.S. is the data that I know best, after the vaccine, this is time, and we approved the vaccine in February 2000, and this is percent penicillin resistant, it was going up slowly in the U.S. or flat, I forget. It was not going up quickly. In any case, it came down, and then this is maybe around 2003 or 4. It started to creep up. And so, as it happened, there was an association between penicillin resistance and other resistances and the vaccine types. So the percent of disease cases that were resistant went down because the disease from the vaccine types, which tended to be resistant, declined and was replaced a little bit, not completely, but replaced a little bit by non-vaccine type disease. And then the story over the last half decade or so has been a rise in resistance among those strains that are not in the vaccine. And type 19A is a sort of famous one in many countries because it's been one of the largest culprits of replacement disease, and it was one of the few very resistant strains even before the vaccine. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And you know, so you're basically taking the midpoint of that sine wave, and that's your
right
for that year, where in fact it can be as high as whatever percent and as low as
right.
1/5 of whatever percent.
Right.
So that's question one. Question two, to what extent, sorry.
Actually, why don't I answer that, because it might address question two as well. So that's sort of what got us started, was that Ron sent us these data in 2006 or 7 or something. And we said, all right, we'll make a model, and it'll be great because we can estimate what is the fitness cost of resistance, because it would be a nice quantitative thing. And so, you know, a year later and much blood, sweat, and tears, mostly by Ted Cohen, we hadn't fit the model, and there were really two problems. So the data we were trying to fit were this. This time, and this is percent resistant. And the two things that happened is when we tried to fit this, we could get lots of model fits that went like that, went down with a sine wave, and others that went up with a sine wave, but we couldn't get them to stay flat with a sine wave. And that's what sort of clued us in about this problem of coexistence in part. Now let me draw a little neater to make the next point. The other problem, which is maybe of some interest to the mathematicians, is that if you have antibiotic use going like this, and you have percent resistant going like this, so that's the data. What the models want to do is to have a quarter period shift. And this is going to really challenge my drawing abilities to try to keep it a quarter period. Yeah, I wrecked it already. You have a quarter period, so this is modeled resistance. And the reason for that is that antibiotic use is a selective agent. In other words, what it does is it tends to make the resistant strain grow relative to the sensitive strain. So a caricature-ish way to write that, which actually turns out to fall out of the equations, is that the derivative of the ratio of resistant to sensitive with respect to time is somehow related to use. So if use is a sine, then this derivative is a cosine. Then this derivative is a sine, and therefore the resistant over sensitive itself, the percent resistance, is going to be a cosine. So it's shifted a quarter period. And the problem with that is that it doesn't seem to fit the data. So it's somehow the bacterial population is adapting almost immediately somehow to the level of antibiotic use, whereas a simple model would predict that there would be some lag. And that's also a piece of it that we don't fully understand. So we're going to try to go back with some of these models that we think have some possible validity, and again, try to fit these data and see whether these models also somehow solve the lag problem. I'm not convinced that they will, but they might. Yeah. So I mean, it does seem as if the bacteria are sort of waking up one day and one hour and doing the right thing for the amount of antibiotics that are there. To my knowledge, there's no equivalent for the variant penicillin binding proteins that are present in penicillin-resistant pneumococcus. I mean, they're just, as far as I know, they are always resistant, and because it's just an inability of the drug to bind to its target. And even if it were varying in the human, the assay is done ex vivo, so it would have to be done, it would have to be varying in the human and then getting stuck that way when you put it on the bacterial plate. So it seems. Yeah. So these data are, kids come in with an ear infection. Their ears are tapped, which is something you don't do for most kids, and I'm not quite sure how they managed. They were doing a research study, I think, a different research study, and this was a byproduct of it. So they actually get some middle ear fluid from the kid. They culture that middle ear fluid. They take the descendants of a single bacterium, a single colony of bacteria, and suspend it in saline solution, and then take somewhat defined equal amounts of that suspension and grow it in twofold dilutions of antibiotic, which then you then read the lowest dilution that inhibits growth as the MIC. Yeah. Yeah.
Then can't you quite rapidly fall back to the sort of explanation you gave the patients in the hospital, that there's going to be a drug use amount in the hospital, and then there's this huge range of susceptibles coming into the hospital. So the immigration is the major driver, and the frequency of the end is determined by drug use practices in the hospital. So if we have the same situation with the kids with the ear infections, if that's a tiny fraction of the world, then the coexistence of the seeing these data are going to be a result of a continual pouring in.
Right. I mean, I think it's possible. The reason that doesn't strike me as particularly likely is twofold. One is that kids of that age, for other reasons, we think are probably the major distributors of this organism to everyone else. And there's various evidence, the most dramatic of which is that when the vaccine was introduced to that age group, the under twos in the U.S., disease rates fell in every age group, despite the fact that those age groups weren't being immunized. Another much more anecdotal but sort of elegant way of seeing this is that, at least before the vaccine, every year at Christmas time, in the two to three weeks after Christmas and New Year's, there was a spike in pneumococcal disease in elderly people in the U.S., and it was pediatric serotypes. That tended to be more in kids, and it went away with the vaccine, and it was true in Sweden as well. There was a nice little paper in the New England Journal of Medicine showing this. So it seems like the kids are the distributors, not the recipients.
Even if that's true, you're not randomly starting on kids between
No.
I mean, if you take the general issue, isn't it going to be an elegant group of population, you've got that equilibrium at some point of state, you get some attempts, you weren't sampling at random, and you're not sampling at random.
I think that's very reasonable, and I don't want to focus all the attention on that one sample. That was a sample that's the one data set that I know of that shows these very dramatic swings from year to year, and is also flat. From season to season, and is flat from year to year. But the other data that show long-term coexistence come from invasive disease, which is also a subset, but it's in all ages. And if you look at individual age groups, the level of resistance may vary, but it's never 100%, and it's never 100% in any serotype. And to the extent that nasopharyngeal carriage studies have been done, which is not as much as we would like. Again, you never see 100% and you never see zero. It's hard to really make the case that in a longitudinal, well, I take that back. I mean, so there's a Massachusetts carriage study that I've been involved in the more recent parts of that was done in 2001, 2004, 2007, and 2009. And there's been a huge turnover of serotypes because the vaccine was coming in, but within each serotype, which you kind of have to stratify because the population's changed so much, resistance maintains at an intermediate frequency. So it's not decades, but it's almost a decade. So I think if the otitis data were the only data, I agree, I wouldn't lean too hard, but I think for coexistence as a fact, I'm fairly convinced because there are just a lot of imperfect data sets that all say the same thing. Yeah.
Every year, when you have a high risk group, you are in the model in a period of 5 or 10 years. The risk group actually are not static. I mean, every year you have a new batch of babies that are born that will move into this susceptible high risk group, and you will have a bunch of people who move out of it because they no longer attend day 10 or they no longer qualify. That is the same model. So I'm interested in your thought about how do you.
Yeah, well, first of all, most of the people who are colonized aren't even sick with the resistant strain, and even if they are sick, there are other ways to treat them besides penicillin, so it's not quite as dire as you described. But the notion that there is that the population is not static, I think, is exactly right, and may be a piece of the explanation, I think. But the hospital situation, the time scale. So in the hospital, the time scale of colonization with most of these organisms is that people get in the hospital is on the order of at least weeks and maybe months or longer for something like Staph aureus or Enterococcus. And the rate of entry and exit for an intensive care unit where most of the action happens is on the order of less than a week. So the time scale of population turnover is much, much faster than the time scale of population bacterial population dynamics. For kids, the opposite is true. The daycare, people are in daycare for a couple of years maybe, and people's colonization duration is on the order of a month or two. So it is true that the population is turning over, but it's not the dominant process in terms of time scale. Yeah. Nope. I told you I was giving you puzzles. I really hope you solve them. But no, so I think, I mean, the basic point is that the reason the lag comes in the model is that we are really focusing on the notion that transmission is affected by treatment, so that the rate of change of resistant over susceptibles is some function of use. If, for example, so suppose we had an infection where there was no transmission, but you had a lot of the emergence of resistance during treatment. So if I get treated, I get resistance with some probability. Then you would have no lag. Then it would just be that resistant that use makes new resistance, and the proportion resistance would track exactly with use. So it somehow suggests that there's some kind of an instantaneous response that's not mediated through these population processes of transmission. And that all sounds reasonable, except that I can't find any biology to back it up.
That's why I asked about the last one. You take fluid from the kids, and then you
treat. Yes, but no, I'm saying I can't find a biological explanation for why the resistance. No, if there were such a thing, then you would not. So I was just trying to explain what it is, what feature of the model makes this lag. There are kids who have had treatment last week, and then you see them. So that's why you have to exclude them to really believe these data. It's not their first time, but the overall data set is kids, including those who got treated yesterday. But the phenomenon persists when you exclude those with treatment in the last, I believe it's 30 or 60 days, I can't remember. There are some which show that, so that the typical study is someone is colonized and maybe also has an ear infection or have, for some reason, they're treated, usually in a study. It's usually comparing drug A versus drug B or dose A versus dose B. So there's not usually a control group, an untreated control group. But you can, somebody is sampled and then treated and then followed up at days 7, 14, and 28 or something. And sort of what you would expect to happen happens if you're harboring a drug-sensitive organism and you're treated, it tends to be cleared and then may come back at some point, either that one or another one. If you're harboring a non-susceptible organism, depending exactly on the drug and the dose, it may be killed because, as I said, non-susceptibility is a continuum. It may not be killed, or it may go away for the first sampling and come back. And there are cases in which someone looks to be carrying just a drug-sensitive organism, and at the next test, they're carrying the drug-resistant organism. And that probably, in many cases, is because they had both, and you only detected the majority, which was the sensitive organism.
You can do prospective sampling of a daycare or a school to see whether these patterns are born out of the microscale?
People have done one daycare or a few daycares at a time. They tend to do it in winter because they get more pneumococcus in winter, and so the sample size, is more convenient. So until this Israeli study came out, I think people weren't looking so much for seasonality. The American system of infectious disease, bacterial infection surveillance, does systematic samples, trying to get everybody in a certain 10%+ of the population. And there's some seasonality to resistance. It's not as pronounced as in the Israeli data, and I don't know whether that has to do with the age groups, different age groups, or what the story is. Oh, one other thing I should have said about the Israeli data. I'm happy to keep talking or answering questions as long as people want. I don't know, should we stop and make it informal, or should we, so there's time for people to have coffee? Yeah, sure. So keep going. Are we done? I still have time to unearn your applause. So what I should have mentioned is that this data that I'm describing and drawing so elegantly is from the Jewish kids in the south of Israel. At the same time, they studied Bedouin kids who have a much higher rate of overall antibiotic use and a much less seasonal. So their use is more like, it's still seasonal in the same way, not to scale, since I just said it was. Their use is much flatter, and their resistance is also much flatter. It's a little bit seasonal. Statistically, it's not clear if it's seasonal, but it's an interesting sort of quasi-equivalent control group where the use is less seasonal and the resistance is less seasonal. I think it depends a lot on the question. I've done that too, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I'm not so much interested in understanding the seasonal variation, although I am interested in that. It's just that I think it helps to reject one hypothesis that had been my favorite hypothesis for why resistance hasn't gone up very quickly. So it's not over many years. So it's not so much that in itself has to be in every model, but rather that I think it helps to reject something that should be in a model, which is how do you maintain coexistence. And I'll use that as an excuse to just make the general point. The reason I harp on this and have been thinking about it for a long time is that, like maybe some other people in the room, you know, I don't really only want to do this sort of ecological studying coexistence because it's interesting, although it is interesting. What I'd really like to do is to be able to, you know, go to public health officials and say, if you change antibiotic use by this much, you'll get this response. And, you know, I've been ready to write that model now for 15 years. And the problem is that it seems to me that if you don't have a model that can reproduce a very fundamental fact about the status quo, then your model is not very trustworthy for projecting forward. And it's the same thing, by the way, for the serotype coexistence in the pneumococcus. Tonight I'm going to WHO to a meeting to discuss the change in serotypes that's happened since the vaccine. And people have made models of this that include antibiotic resistance and many serotypes and 35 different parameters, but they don't have a very good explanation either for why there are multiple serotypes instead of one of them winning, because they also differ in fitness, nor do they have a good explanation for why there's coexistence of resistant and sensitive strains. And so it seems to me that to then take such a model and try to predict the future with it is a dangerous game. So the goal of all this is partly to get the science right and partly to have what to me would feel like enough basic understanding of the mechanisms of biology so that you can then go forward and do what some of us would really like to do. But the flip side of that is that I think I would be skeptical of efforts to be too quantitative in predicting the future without getting some basic facts about the present, right? Jonathan, take issue with that. Yeah, it seems to be the best correlation is a 1 month lag, and 3 months is a lot worse fit than 1 month. Yeah. I mean, I think it may be that lack of lag is just because of some combination of the questions that have been mostly coming from this side of the room, that basically there's something funny about this data. It's not representative. I think that's a real possibility because I don't have any better explanation, but I don't see a reason to think that the data are that unrepresentative because the phenomenon sticks around when you exclude those with recent treatment. Yeah, I mean, in the simplest model, I guess I probably should have actually written down some equation during this whole talk, since this is a Fields Institute, but I think my feeling was that I would be embarrassed by any equation I would write down here, so I should just... the basic model is that the rate of change in people with the drug-sensitive strain is some transmission term, and X is the uncolonized people. Something like this. There is a nonlinear term, which is the transmission term. And when you then do some simple rearranging, the rate of change is equal, in the ratio is equal to, which we're going to call rho, is equal to beta r minus beta s rho x minus tau rho, if I'm not mistaken. Or tau, yeah, I think it's tau rho. I think that's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, so if this is a sine, then r over s is a cosine. So, if you had a different kind of nonlinearity, then it might be somehow different. Yeah. A nice thing about this for people who do sort of biostatistics is that it means that the logit of rho is equal to all of that times time plus a constant. So the if you do a logistic regression of the probability of resistance against time, you recover this difference in fitness. But it may or may not represent reality. But I mean, this is a classic way that you model transmission, that you have that it's proportional jointly to the density of the transmitters and the transmittees. All right, here we are.
I think I'm going to.
Okay.
Relieve you of your very, very extended duty up here. Thank you very much. I think the flood of questions was reflective of how much we all enjoyed your talk. And
good.
Thank you for creating more questions than you tried to definitively answer.
Good.
Fantastic. Right. Very much in the spirit of what we'll try to do over the next few days. So thank Mark very much, and thank you.